Hello, everybody, and welcome back to We've Got Mail. Yeah. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a critic. For the purposes of this particular podcast, you can call me Ruckmeister McCool, if you wish.
Most do. And this is We've Got Mail. This is where you control the conversation right here, the Critically Acclaimed Network. Here's how it works. You send us an email. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. You ask us a question. You comment on something you've heard in one of our podcasts. Sometimes people give us important corrections when we get something wrong. Always exciting to learn more about stuff. This is your place. This is your place to get us to talk about whatever you want. So we're always very grateful for that. You also, if you so choose, can send us a physical letter or some other package sometimes, if you wish, some have, to our P.O. Box. Whitney, what is our P.O. Box?
Yeah, send it to the Critically Acclaimed Network. I'm stumbling a lot today. The Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
And we always, if we get stuff in the P.O. Box, we always begin with that. Yeah. So, Whitney, we actually have something this week.
We did. We got in
this
our...
This is exciting.
It didn't come with a letter, though, so there's nothing for me to read. This comes from somebody named David. Thank you, David. From Ireland.
Ooh, very exciting.
This is an international package that somebody bothered to send, par avion.
I've done international shipping. It's not easy, I do appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Yeah. And what they sent us was we each got a book of 4 postage stamps.
Yeah, this is really cool, by the way.
And these, of course, these are not for us to use on American letters.
No, I don't think they would work.
They wouldn't be valid here in the United States. But they are photographs of Irish Academy Award winners.
Yeah.
And they're holding their Oscar statuettes on the stamps.
It's very cool.
There's one of Brenda Fricker and Daniel Day-Lewis for My Left Foot.
Yep, there's one for Neil Jordan winning for The Crying Game.
Here's Martin McDonagh for Six Shooter,
which was a short film he made.
Yeah.
Here's Glenn Hansard and Marketa Irglova. Sorry, it's type's a little small, but it's a little dark in here. Winning Best Original Song for Once.
Yeah.
And that is very neat.
And these are. These are nicer than American
stamps. These are
stamps.
Way nicer than American.
These are like
American stamps
printed
suck.
On nice paper stock.
Yeah, you've got like texture to them. Although, I feel like you remember like the entomologist in The Silence of the Lambs? Someone loved this.
Someone loved him.
Fed it deadly nightshade, kept it warm. Like that's how I feel about these stamps. Someone loved these stamps.
These are wonderful stamps.
These are great.
Thank you for these stamps.
Thank you.
Oh yeah, we'll keep these in our collection.
We absolutely will. I have a shelf stuff we received from our fans.
This is, Irish movie stars. I'm going to put this in my copy of James Joyce's Ulysses as
Ooh,
my little bookmark.
That's lovely.
Keep the Irish thing going a little bit.
That's really fun. So listen, thank you so much for sending that. That's really, really appreciated. These are really cool.
Yeah.
Neat. Did you ever collect stamps as a kid?
I've always liked stamps. I've never collected or kept them, though. Yeah. I just, when I go to the post office, I always make sure to sort of get the most interesting ones, but then I use them.
I went through a brief stamp collecting phase when I was young. I never really got into it enough to really know what I was doing, but there was this really cool hobbyist shop that had tons of stamps. Like really old stuff, and I would just pour through them and pick the stuff I thought looked cool.
Yeah.
So somewhere in my parents' house, there's a stamp collecting book. Famous. Rare, like in the movie Charade, kind of stamp in there that's like worth $1 billion that I don't know about, but man.
I know the glue is eventually it would dry out and become unreliable, but I wish they would go back to lick stamps.
Yeah, those are fun.
Also, it's less waste. All of the adhesive stamps have to come with a paper backing, and you just throw that away. So, lick stamps, you just lick the stamp on and you put it on. There's no backing. There's less waste.
There's a little thin strip of, just to connect them all. But, it's almost no waste.
Yeah. As opposed to these ones, which have these huge
plastic
sheets.
I'm going to put this on my shelf right now.
Read
the first letter.
All right. And we get letters besides. Here's our first email. It comes from RJ. Hello, RJ.
Hi, RJ.
Dear Bibbs and Whitney, I'll get straight to the point. Oh, good. Okay. you can ramble, actually. We don't care. Do you think the best adapted screenplay award at the Academy Awards should be judged on the quality of the screenplay itself or how well it has been adapted from the source material? And further to that, how often do you think the source material actually comes into play when voting? To save Bibbs the explaining, the best adapted screenplay category focuses on the screenplay that are based on other works, whether it's an adaptation of book, play, comic book, TV show, or a remake or a sequel of another film, hence why films like Toy Story 2 and 3 have been nominated.
Yeah.
Now, it seems more likely to me that these screenplays are judged more often on the quality of their writing as opposed to how well they are adapted. Realistically, how many Academy members have read the books or watched the original films or seen or TV shows or read the comic books, etc.? There'd be far too many people who likely wouldn't be qualified to make that judgment. But the issue I have with that is that there is little distinction between original adapted screenplay if we're judging them based on their quality. Defeats the point of recognizing adapted work. I think back to the 2020 ceremony when Joker, Little Women, and Jojo Rabbit were nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay, with Jojo Rabbit winning. I was rooting for Little Women that year, not only because it was the best film nominated, but because I had read only a small portion of the book, yet I could tell how transformative Greta Gerwig's take was in many ways.
Yeah.
I haven't read Caging Skies, which is the book Jojo Rabbit is based on, but I can imagine people being impressed with how Taika Waititi took a dramatic novel and turned it into a comedy. The plot is mostly the same, as far as I'm aware, minus the humor and imaginary Hitler. I remember reading an interview with Taika Waititi. They said, "What kind of research did you do to play Adolf Hitler?" He said, "None." I'm honoring that fuck.
Yeah, I did appreciate that.
And then you have Joker, which is apparently inspired by The Killing Joke and The Dark Knight Returns, but according to Todd Phillips, it doesn't follow any of those comic books, and is instead just an adaptation of the character, at which point, how the fuck do you judge that? And could you justifiably, if cheekily, judge it based on its inspiration from Scorsese movies? That would have been interesting.
That would have been fair, I think.
Best adapted screenplay, Joker, based kind of on The King of Comedy.
Not kind of, almost very, very, very explicitly. Yeah.
I'm sure the answer is simple, but I want to hear your thoughts. Honest. Oh. Bonus question, if you think Best Picture was better off limited to 5 films, or are you glad that it's a solid 10? And if you had to reduce this year's nominees to 5, what would you pick? Mine would be very easy: Drive My Car, Coda, Dune, The Power of the Dog, and Nightmare Alley. Licorice Pizza is mostly great, but the third act meanders like hell. King Richard is a perfectly good sports biopic, but it isn't really special. West Side Story is an impressively made chore. Oh, I love West Side Story. Belfast is sometimes cute, but mostly incompetent. And Don't Look Up.
It's a little harsh on Belfast, yeah, but okay.
Yeah. I like Belfast as
Everyone's
well.
Everyone's allowed.
Thanks for the great work as always. Hope you're both well, RJ. Thank you for writing in, RJ.
That's a really great question, RJ. And here's how the Academy works, if anyone... RJ did a great job of explaining the category, but I want to make something clear about how the Academy collects nominations. Because... the question remains, like, if this is not your field, how does someone who doesn't know how sound design works vote for best sound? This is a problem we run into every single year. However, the nominations come from a specific branch of the Academy. So only the people who work in sound design...
are nominating the sound Oscars.
Yeah, everyone nominates for Best Picture. That's an aggregate of everyone. But you only nominate for whatever branch, or occasionally branches. Some people are, like, in writing and directing, you know... Usually it's only one, though. Mm-hmm. So theoretically, the people who are nominating for the films that are nominated, the 5 films in any given category, know what they're talking about. They have a close relationship to the craft, and they have a general sense, theoretically, of what is good and what is bad, or at least what is considered of high quality at the moment. So theoretically... the people who are in the writer's branch who are nominating for Best Adapted Screenplay and Original, they really know what they're talking about when it comes to, like, oh, that was really hard, or that's a really, really great screenplay. But the question is, how do we judge what is a great adaptation? Is it just the quality of the end result? Or do we take the difficulty of the adaptation, or at the very least the transformative power, or even the accuracy, into account? I think in a perfect world, everyone would have the opportunity and the time to read the stuff this is based on, or watch it in the case of something like Coda, which is based on a French film. I think that would be very illuminating. I haven't read, obviously, every single thing that's ever been adapted and been nominated for Best Adapted Feature, for Best Adapted Screenplay, but a lot of stuff that I have a lot of respect for it. One screenplay I keep coming back to over and over again, because if you read this book, and it's a great book, and then you see the movie, you see that movie is great, they worked their asses off to turn that into a movie, because that's really complicated, is L.A. Confidential.
Yeah, yeah,
they removed major subplots. They combined characters. That whole thing with Rolo Tomasi, it's arguably like the biggest gut punch scenes in the movie, entirely invented for the film. The final shootout in L.A. Confidential, the movie, is literally the first scene of the book. It's a gigantic change. Mm-hmm. And yet it captures the spirit perfectly. That's really, really complicated. And then, of course, there's stuff that is more straightforward. Kenneth Branagh was nominated for not changing Hamlet.
He did turn it into a movie.
And yeah.
He didn't just sort of like hand around the first folio and say, just do that.
But basically what he did was he said, here's where this scene takes place, here's the context of this scene. And he didn't write any new dialogue. He didn't even change any scenes around. He just did the play. And
which
was a good choice.
And, well, I was going to say, that's an adaptation choice, isn't it?
But it's hard to compare them. I'm curious, actually, what he was up to, what he was up against. Okay, so that year.
That was 96.
96.
So up against Jerry Maguire. No,
not quite. Adapted. Not quite. Here's what was nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay in 1996. Hamlet did not win.
English Patient won, right?
The English Patient was nominated. It's actually one of the few Oscars that didn't win.
Fargo won. No, Fargo's not adapted either.
Shh.
I'm trying to guess.
Okay. Sling Blade won.
That's right. Sling Blade won.
Okay. Sling Blade, which is based on a short film by Billy Bob Thornton, then he turned it into a feature. The Crucible was nominated. Arthur Miller did the adaptation.
Great. I haven't seen that version.
Oh, yeah, it's very good. It's very, very good. Anthony Minghella was nominated for The English Patient. Kenneth Branagh was nominated for Hamlet. And John Hodge was nominated for Trainspotting, which is another book I've read. And I don't know how the fuck he did that.
Because
that book is just a weird collection of anecdotes. Mm. Like, there's no through line whatsoever. And honestly, if I were voting, I think having... I've seen the short film, some folks call it a Sling Blade. I've seen original productions of The Crucible. I don't think I've ever actually sat down and read it.
Mm.
I read some of the novel of The English Patient, but I didn't care for it, so I stopped. And I've read Hamlet, I've seen Hamlet, and I've read Trainspotting. Of all of those, I would say Trainspotting is the most complicated adaptation. The most difficult thing to transform into a movie, and if we're basing it on that scale, you kind of have to give the Trainspotting.
Okay.
As for what's the best screenplay, I think it's a toss-up between Trainspotting and Sling Blade. I think those are both really, really good scripts.
Yeah.
What about you? What do you think?
I think when it comes to an adapted screenplay, accuracy to source material be damned. It does not matter how close it is.
Well, if it's a good idea to keep it close, it matters, I suppose.
No. I don't even think that's true.
You don't think you're making that choice and you have to stick by that choice and it matters?
No, I don't think so. I think when you're writing a screenplay, that's your screenplay, and you can write it however the hell you want.
Well, I'm not talking about the fealty police coming after you. I'm just saying you choose what to stay close to, and you choose what to change, and sometimes you don't end up with a good movie at the end.
I think or sometimes you do. Maybe all of the changes you made it a better screenplay.
Yeah, I'm just saying, I don't think there's one way to do it.
When you're judging a sort of best adapted screenplay, and this is always the way I've thought of it, is it's just the quality of the screenplay. You wrote a good screenplay. The only thing they're acknowledging is it wasn't your idea.
I suppose that's
true. It wasn't your story or it wasn't your character. You're taking somebody else's idea and making your interesting story out of it. And that's all we're acknowledging.
You know what I wish
you didn't invent that story. You didn't invent those characters. Hence, Joker, just the character, that's not your character.
Yeah,
you can write whatever story you want with the Joker, but it does belong to somebody else, and somebody else invented it.
I'm curious.
And now if you're going to use those character names, and you're going to use the setting, and you're going to use the sort of the context of the character, however you're going to use it, you are adapting someone else's work. If you do it really, really well, you get an Oscar nomination.
I'm doing a quick scan over the best original screenplay nominations to see if there's any, like, well, you didn't invent that character.
And we're not talking about character.
Well, like, Topsy-Turvy was nominated for best original screenplay. That's a biopic.
Yeah.
So they didn't invent those characters either.
No, but that's real history. That's real life. That's not copyright. And that's not somebody else's
written
story.
So if you do the... So if you... One second. Let me ask. If you do the research... on a pre-existing real story, it's an original screenplay.
That's
someone else does it and turns it into a book and you turn that into an adapted screenplay, then it's an adapted screenplay.
That's right.
Seems a little nebulous to me, but...
Well,
you're still taking something that isn't yours.
Well, but if you're doing the research, if you're just researching real life, that's just people's lives. You can write about real life. You can write about your own life. You can write about William Gilbert and Sir Arthur Sullivan all you like. Mm-hmm. If you know a lot about them, write a story about them, and all of that, all of their dialogue is now yours.
Yeah,
I really love Topsy Turvy.
Yeah, good, really good movie. Yeah, I like it a lot. That's no slight against Topsy Turvy. I'm just saying one could make the argument if you really.
But if somebody else
to.
Did all the research, they did all the work for you, didn't they? So you're still getting a little bit of a leg up.
Okay, well then here's my question, and this is a fun debate though, because there's no like right answer to this. These are all like definitions we've kind of made up. Mm-hmm. Best original screenplay, best adapted screenplay. You know, there's no one right way to look at this. But there's a debate that we have, and decisions had to be made. And once the Academy makes a decision, they have to stick to it. Makes sense. Here's my question to you. If all we're acknowledging in Best Adapted Screenplay is that you didn't come up with the original work. Mm-hmm. You didn't originally create the character, you didn't originally tell the story.
Yeah, somebody else's work that you turned into a screenplay.
Ergo, you would not be here were it not for this other person. They're the ones who are the reason we're here, technically.
Yeah.
Should not the Oscar be shared between you and the original writer or storyteller?
Well, I mean, they didn't write it, did they? They didn't write the screenplay.
First draft.
But the award's going to the screenplay.
Uh huh.
You're not going to give an Oscar to Shakespeare because he wrote Hamlet.
Why not? He wrote Hamlet.
He's dead.
He wrote Hamlet.
he didn't know from movies. He only saw a couple. Sorry, that's me being cheeky.
Okay. In any case, regarding the second...
It seems pretty clear-cut to me.
Well,
if you're writing a screenplay based on some... And they even say adapted from a material previously published.
Yeah.
So it's been, you know, legally sanctified in a certain way. It is already out there in the world for the public to consume in a previous form, and you turn it into a new form, that's an adapted screenplay.
Yeah. I agree with Whitney that what really matters is how it turns out. I think in a perfect world, we'd have all the information necessary to really understand the depth of the work that someone did in any field, not just adapted screenplay, but in production design or whatever. You would understand the difficulty level and what they did, what the specific challenges were involved that made their achievement unique, maybe not better than, but unique from everyone else's achievement that year. And you do that for all the nominees in every category.
There's a film based on the life and opinions of Tristram Shandy Gentleman by Lawrence Stern. It's an early 18th century novel. They actually repeat a very popular criticism of the book where they say, it was a postmodern novel before there was a modern to be post to. something professors will say about Tristram Shandy. And Michael Winterbottom adapted that book into a movie called Tristram Shandy, A Cock and Bull Story. It starred Steve Coogan. And that book is unadaptable. It's the whole gag with the book is it's about a character named Tristram Shandy is going to tell you his life. He's going to tell you his life story. And he sits down and says, I'm going to tell you all of my life story. And he gets so distracted with asides and little anecdotes and little side stories about other members of his family that the last thing that happens in the book is that he's born. Like, just the whole book
never gets
to the point. And in the last page, they say, what was the story about? A cock and a bull, and better for it. And that's where we get the term cock and bull story. I think trying to adapt that, something as opaque and oblique and strange as Tristram Shandy, into a film at all is going to be a monumental achievement. Mm-hmm. Tristram Shandy wasn't up for any Academy Awards. I think that's... And also, the adaptation tried to, rather than adapt sort of the events of the book, turn it into, kind of like the movie adaptation, the trouble of turning that book into a movie. So it's about a movie set, and they're trying to make the Tristram Shandy movie. So there's scenes from the Lawrence Stern book, and also like executives trying to rewrite the script and figure out what the
heck. So it's a post-postmodern.
It's like post-postmodern, yeah.
Yeah. And which some might just call insufferable.
So Steve Coogan plays Tristram Shandy, but he also plays Steve Coogan himself, who is also playing this role. Which, doing that postmodern thing with the feature film is actually really true to the spirit of the book. That's actually a really good way to adapt that book, even if it's not a direct adaptation of the material itself. That was a great adaptation. Is it a great screenplay? I think so. Mm-hmm. Was it up for awards? No. Nobody, because it's too strange, I think. And also, a lot of people aren't familiar with Lawrence Stern. He's sort of for like deep cut lit nerds.
The second half of the email was about Best Picture.
Yeah.
And how this year there were 10 nominees. For the last 10 years or so, the rule was it was between 5 and 10, depending on where, how many, who, what movies got the most nominations.
Hmm.
And then briefly before that, it was 10. Then for most of Academy history, it was only 5. But before the mid-1940s, there were 10, usually. It's all arbitrary. Every single one of those is arbitrary. I personally like that when there's 10, because I think that there's always only like two or three films that have a realistic shot, because it is a popularity contest.
Well, let's not talk about odds.
Well, I'm just saying.
In an ideal world.
If people are thinking about like, oh, will it help handicap? I don't give a shit. But realistically, only a couple of them really have a chance at winning the popularity contest every year. But what's cool about it is that it creates a snapshot of what was being celebrated that year. Now, there's always stuff that's left out. That's, some of them get nominated for the other awards, and that's nice, but there's always something that's going to get left out. The Academy always has their favorite type of things. Biopics are very, very big with them. But we have a podcast called Only the Best on our Patreon, patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork, where we've been reviewing every single film ever nominated for Best Picture in order, and we've been going through the 1930s and the 1940s, and every year there's like, meh, depending on the year, between like 2 and 5 movies people really know, like if only by name. And then there's always a bunch of films that have kind of gone by the wayside in history. And having, you know, having that, their names inscribed in history, having their names inscribed to the Academy Awards, means that we're more likely to go back and revisit them. Gives us an excuse to do so. Reminds us that, that there was a time when these films, even if they're considered less significant now, were considered the most significant of the year. And I think it's really exciting. In the moment, it might just seem like a jumble of movies. But in 50 years, this is an interesting crop we had this year. It's not just a whole bunch of biopics. We had a very sweet family film about a young teenager growing up in a deaf family. We had a somewhat nostalgic, somewhat bittersweet biopic of Kenneth Branagh as a child. We had a sci-fi ensemble comedy about how we're all going to die and it's all our fault. We had a Japanese film about a director who's like putting on an avant-garde version of Uncle Vanya while being chauffeured around town and listening to an audio cassette of his dead wife. We had Dune, which was this giant epic, you know, humongoid franchise event. We had King Richard, which, before the narrative changed, was like a very sweet film about the two biggest tennis stars in the world and how much they love their dad and they want to make a movie about that. We have Paul Thomas Anderson remembers the 70s.
Remember that?
Yeah. We had Nightmare Alley, a big film noir remake from Guillermo del Toro. We had The Power of the Dog, which is a, you know, a queer Western. And we had West Side Story.
Spoilers.
Big... I guess we all know. It's pretty obvious early on.
I suppose so.
And
the queerness is like kind of the twist in that movie.
I don't think it's the twist. I think it's the point. I think it's what
Well, it's the point, but they kind of...
Where it comes from, whatever, who cares? And then there's West Side Story, which is a big, giant, opulent Hollywood musical remake. That's a big variety of films, and if there were only 5 of those, a lot of those wouldn't get like that kind of representation. They wouldn't be part of the snapshot of this year. Which 5 would I have chosen? I probably wouldn't have chosen most of these for Best Picture. If I nominated 10, I would have nominated maybe 3 or 4 of these. I probably would have nominated... I definitely would have nominated The Power of the Dog. I definitely would have nominated Drive My Car.
Yes.
Those are the two I absolutely... of those 10, absolutely would have nominated them. Of the others, the ones that I'm like, yeah, okay, fine. I think West Side Story, miscast lead aside, is a handsome production. Probably would have gone for that. Belfast is... I appreciate that some might find it, you know, a little conventional in some ways, but very well crafted. So I wouldn't mind that. And probably Coda. Coda is a sweet film. I got nothing against Coda. Other than I don't think they understand how teaching choir works very well. But other than that, it's a very sweet film. I got nothing against it. What about you? If you had to pick five of this year's crop.
Of those?
Only of the nominees. Because obviously, I mean, personally, I would totally switch some out with The Worst Person in the World or Tick, Tick, Boom or The Lost Daughter. You know?
Where was In the Heights this year? Nobody liked In the Heights. I don't know why. It's such a good movie. It's such a brilliant movie.
I think it deserved at least cinematography and supporting actress. Bare minimum.
I would have chosen Drive My Car. I would have chosen Power of the Dog. I would have chosen West Side Story.
Yeah.
Just because I actually like those movies quite a lot.
Yeah.
I would not have nominated King Richard.
No.
That's sort of meh.
Yeah. Good performances, maybe screenplay, but I wasn't so
impressed with Dune. Actively dislike both Nightmare Alley and Licorice Pizza.
I like Nightmare Alley fine, but I think it's too bloated to be Best Picture nominee. It should have been shorter. It should have been tighter.
Rather than have the first 45 minutes, just lop all that off. The whole thing. All of the carnival stuff.
I think you can get through it faster. Have you seen the original?
No.
Much tighter, not as good an ending.
Okay.
That's the thing. I think the perfect Nightmare Alley is the original film, the new ending. Or rather, the original ending that the Breschen Code wouldn't let them use.
Which Guillermo del Toro put back.
Would do it, and it's a great ending. It's a damn near perfect ending. But here you
go. And I guess Belfast, because I think Belfast is quite sweet. And it is, you know, sort of about Irish history. But, you know, I like the sort of low camera child's perspective of this big point in history rather than sort of belaboring it. It is about sort of the things that concern a child and getting a good math score so you can sit next to the kid you have a crush on in class.
Belfast is one of those movies where, you know, you watch it and it's like, this is a well-made movie. There's really nothing wrong with this movie. It just doesn't have that, like, holy shit impact.
Uh-huh.
So when you put it next to movies that arguably do, you just sort of look at it and go, really? But there's nothing wrong with it. It's just on its own. It's a lovely film.
I was actually just on my phone trying to find my top 20 list.
Of the best
films that I said were the best. Mine went through
a couple of permutations since because I hadn't seen The Worst Person in the World. It definitely would have made my top 10.
Yeah, I think mine would too.
And honestly, I think Encanto would have at least cracked my top 20.
Oh, really?
Like, I really quite fell in love with Encanto. Right. I think it's a really, really excellent film.
Yeah, my number one was Labyrinth of Cinema.
Yes, I remember that. Yeah.
Nobuhiko Obayashi film. My number two was Days, the Tsai Ming-Lang film, which nobody talked about other than critics. My number three was Summertime.
Mm-hmm.
And my number four was Drive My Car. So I also had a... The Power of the Dog I guess the number doesn't matter, but The Power of the Dog was in my top 10 as well.
Did any of my top 10 get nominated for any? None. The only one of my top 10 that got nominated for anything at the Oscars was The Mitchells vs. the Machines.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Although The Worst Person in the World would have cracked that, so I guess it would have. But my number one was Summertime. My number two was Psycho Gorman, and I stand by that. My number three was The Harder They Fall. My number four was Titan. My number five was Quo Vadis, Aida. The Fear Street trilogy, The Amusement Park, Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar. Mm-hmm. Pig should have been nominated for something.
At least actor.
Holy shit.
Yeah, I was. Sorry, go on.
No, you know, we should go on, actually. Right. I think we've talked about this a lot. But
I just like reminiscing on
this. I know. Movies, but... Those are the days, right? Remember when we were younger and more innocent?
I wish that I knew what I know. Never mind.
What do we got next?
Let's read another letter.
Please.
Here is a letter from... where is the name? Dr. Nova.
Oh, hi, Dr. Nova.
Hi, Dr. Nova. We've heard from Dr. Nova before. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Your conversations of movies not being on streaming is the conversation on piracy.
Yes, that's indeed a big part of it. It is.
If you go on YouTube right now, you can find movies that people have uploaded and studios don't care about.
Yeah.
In Search of Dr. Seuss.
Seuss. Most people say Seuss, but Seuss is technically correct.
So yeah, In Search of Dr. Seuss. Mm-hmm. I watched it for free, and it was interesting. I hear The Cat in the Hat talk about Nazis and name drop Hitler. I haven't seen that either.
I know
Dr. Seuss did
political cartoons.
Yeah, like political cartoons in the day. There's a really rather chilling picture of, I think it's British Parliament, or maybe it's, I think he was living in England at the time. I actually don't know his biography very well. But it's like a meeting of politicians, and the building's ceiling has been blown open, and they're all wearing gas masks, but they're still like sort of debating policy. That's a very pretty potent image.
Very potent image.
And B, seeing the director in comments writing about how he loved watching his movie again.
Yeah.
So yeah, the director's film is lost. The director wants you to see that.
Yeah.
Maybe they're not getting money for it.
I'm sure they would prefer it if it was available, you know, legally, and they could get some money off of it. But at least it's out there. Yeah.
Ooh. What's My Line is a panel show from the 1950s and 1960s. I know What's My Line.
Mm-hmm.
And this channel's entire thing is fighting and hosting what I assume is their favorite show. Have you ever seen What's My Line?
No, I don't think I know of it, but I don't think I've ever watched it.
Yeah, it's
different from Whose Line Is It Anyway. It's totally different thing.
No, What's My Line is a game show. Somebody steps forward and they say, like, you have to guess what their profession is.
Oh, yeah, I've seen bits of that, yeah.
Right.
This person has an interesting job.
Yeah.
So What's My Line is not like What's My Line of Dialogue, it's What's My Line of Work.
What's My Line of Work, yeah.
Ah, okay, then I have seen that, but for some reason I thought it was called something else. Yeah. Okay.
Similar but different is directors who can't get streaming services on board... full movies on their YouTube channel. They bore out their full movies on their YouTube channels or sell it through their own website.
Right.
So it doesn't belong to them, but they're kind of doing it underhandedly.
I think Frank Oz did that with Muppet People Talking. It was only available like through his own website. It's a cute little documentary about just all the various, well, not all, but a lot of the various Muppet puppeteers getting together and reminiscing about the old days, and that's it. That's the whole movie. It's interesting if you like Muppets, which most people do.
We covered a show on Cancel Too Soon called The Edge. It was an incredibly violent sketch comedy show from the early 90s on Fox. Yeah. A show that I was very fond of when it aired.
Yeah.
We saw it because of an enterprising fan.
Yeah,
they were able to find it for us, and then we were able to watch it, so thank you. But Julie Brown, the star and producer of that show, not the downtown variety.
No, the uptown Julie Brown.
Original recipe. Yeah. She was able to somehow get like some limited rights to both The Edge and her sitcom, Strip Mall.
Oh.
And she was just selling homemade DVDs from her own website.
That's nice.
So that was a way to kind of get it legit, and you're just giving money straight to Julie Brown.
That's great. Yeah. Julie Brown deserves it.
Mm. I don't think any of the other actors on the show got any royalties.
Well, you know.
But, you know, it also has...
There's nothing's perfect.
It also has Wayne Knight and Tom Kenny and Jennifer Aniston. These people are doing fine. I don't think they're hurting for their Edge royalties, you know?
Picturing Jennifer Aniston like slamming her fist on a desk, like, get me those Edge royalties! I want that 25 cents!
I was gonna get that gumball! John Schnepp sold his movie through his website, and Ash Coyote? Put a documentary on the queer history of furries on her channel because the pandemic stopped the film festivals that they were going to be going to. Thanks, Dr. Nova. P.S. The Cat in the Hat talked about the propaganda Dr. Seuss wrote, so it wasn't entirely out of nowhere. But it was in a cartoon house, so it was a little weird.
That's an excellent point.
If a film is not available and a studio who owns it or whoever owns the film, and you know who owns the film, refuses to put it out, doesn't know if they have it or not, or you don't know who owns it,
or they don't care.
That's when a pirate becomes an archivist.
Yeah.
They're not engaging in some sort of illicit activity. They are, but in a cool way.
Well, I don't support piracy when there's a legal, reasonable way to get the movie. Like, if you're just like pirating Spider-Man No Way Home because you can't be bothered to wait until it's on streaming, fuck you. That's not cool. You don't need to do that. If, on the other hand, here's a movie that is available no other way, maybe it aired on television, no one knows or cares who owns the rights to it, and you put that on YouTube, you're a hero. Because otherwise, that thing will just be lost to history. Because people who own it probably don't give a shit or don't think there's a market for it. And as a result, they'll never put it out because there's nothing in it for them.
Yeah.
Especially when you consider that a lot of the older media that we're talking about, some of it was, a lot of it isn't taken care of very well. The money it would take to clean it up nice and make it, you know, sort of presentation worthy, probably is more than they would actually make releasing the film in a lot of these cases.
Too obscure to really have a big audience to pay for all
of
that.
So if Disney actually did put out the 100 Lives of Black Jack Savage on Disney Plus, and they just kept it in the VHSs that it has now, you would click on it and go, what the fuck, Disney, you cheap Cheapskates? What the hell? But like, if but to spend the money on it might not make a lot of sense. On the other hand, knowing that Blackjack Savage is on YouTube, even in VHS format, is, oh, thank God, there's an archive.
Yeah.
It exists out there. Historians can find it. And sometimes these things are really interesting and really important. And thank God they're available somehow. We want the art to be available.
I always come down on Disney, give them a lot of shit, and they deserve it.
They do.
But I would subscribe to a Disney streaming service if it was a low-quality archive of their entire catalog.
Literally everything
and
they
got. Anything not on Disney+.
Yeah.
Just everything else that they do own.
Yeah.
Just put
including
in,
Fox and all
the
that
Fox stuff.
Shit.
Just the entire back catalog of all of that
every,
stuff that they
every
own.
Episode of Mouser Size. Like, literally everything they don't think you give a shit. Some of Disney's material is actually lost media.
Yeah.
Well, some of the early Disney Channel shows, like Dumbo's Flying Circus. It was a live-action kids show with, like, an animatronic Dumbo. I believe that one, a significant number of episodes are considered lost.
Okay.
Just because no one cared.
Mm-hmm.
It's like when we lost a lot of early episodes of Doctor Who. No one was concerned about archiving them because it was just some throw-off TV show.
Although they found them in, like, Ethiopia or something.
Some of them got found. Some of them got found. Some of them only the audio got found, and they, like, ended up making an animated movie out of it. But, like, regardless, not everything is available, but everything you got, make it available.
I actually had a conversation with a friend of mine named Kyle. Old colleague of mine. We were co-workers at Nerdist way, way back in the day. And he's the biggest Doctor Who fan I've ever met. And he knows a lot about Doctor Who. And evidently they found the video for a lot of those early Doctor Who episodes.
Yeah.
But they didn't have the audio. The audio was corrupted or they just didn't have the audio for some reason. But there were enough nerdy fans out there who held up cassette recorders to their TVs and recorded the audio that way.
Yeah.
But they were able to resync like fan audio back to the original.
That's really cool.
I like stories like that.
That's really cool. Mm-hmm. And that, again, so many movies have been lost to history.
Mm-hmm.
And when you think about it, so many books. Probably most of the books ever written.
Oh, yeah.
Like lost history. Well, you think about like the Library of Alexandria, which is supposed to be like the greatest collection of
knowledge
knowledge ever collected up until it got burned down and Julius Caesar was just like, let it. And Cleopatra was like, can we please not? And Julius Caesar's like, no, man stuff is happening.
Did you ever see that film Agora?
No, I heard about it though.
Yeah, but it's like a biopic of Hypatia, the astronomer, and Rachel Weisz plays Hypatia. It points out this the library at Alexandria was burned down by early Christians who were sort of going a little mad that we can't have old Roman religion. It all has to be the Christian religion now. It's like this holy crusade by early Christians to burn down all sources of knowledge.
Yeah, that tracks.
Yeah, it is a brazenly atheistic movie.
Yeah.
There's a lot of shots of like everybody's like warring and bickering about religion and what they're going to do. And they're burning stuff down. And then the director cuts to a high shot of the whole planet. It's like the curve of the earth. We are but insects. None of this has meaning. It's a bit much. I think it's a good film.
I live in this weird state of vague dread.
Uh-huh.
That because when you think about it, you know, you go back far enough, we only have so many stories from antiquity that survived.
Mm.
You know, like you go back and, oh, there's Beowulf, and then there's nothing before Beowulf.
Gilgamesh.
There's nothing before Gilgamesh. It's
the
oldest story we got. And it's considered in many respects foundational towards a lot of storytelling because of it. Mm-hmm. What if that sucked? What if when Gilgamesh came out, it was Morbius? It was just this bullshit, larger-than-life story.
It was considered
a bad story, but for whatever reason, it was someone's favorite book. They kept it polybagged, and like it's the only thing that survived thousands of years later. And now we think like Morbius is the most important movie ever made because, hey, it's the only one that survived, right?
I've seen plenty of science fiction stories like that. There's a joke about that in Mortal Engines, bomb movie where they're looking at like artifacts from the old world, things they've salvaged from centuries ago.
Yeah, they're looking at these statues of golden idols.
They're golden the god. These must have been the gods they worshipped, and they were minions from a Minions movie.
Which is a good joke.
Cute little joke.
It's a good joke. Yeah. I live in horror of that.
That will be remembered for.
So I want as much to be preserved as possible, so that Morbius is not the only thing that survives into the future. I know we should move on, but thank you for that. It's a good point. Thank you for everyone who is keeping that alive.
Yeah.
Within reason.
So yeah, don't buy and sell stuff that's not yours. But if you know it's not available, by all means, keep it alive.
Yeah.
Keep that VHS tape that you have
TV movie. And my rule is, if you ever like watch something on YouTube, because like there's a movie that I don't think Tag the Assassination Game has ever been released on like home video, or maybe like VHS, but never since. It's a film, early film by Nick Castle, who directed The Last Starfighter. It's got stars Linda Hamilton, and it is about a game of like tag that is being played across an entire college campus. It's like the latest fad or whatever. But someone starts taking it too seriously, starts killing people, and nobody realizes it until it's too late. And it's a really, really fun movie. I don't think it's ever been released on home video, but if it ever is released on home video, I feel obligated to buy it.
Yeah.
Because, like, hey, I was the one who was helping keep it alive and showing that there was interest in it. I feel like, if possible, you want to show your support for the people who actually are trying to put it out there and say, oh, you like that? You want that you want that available? Cool, here it is. Okay, fine. Here's some money.
I did that. A cartoon show I was very fond of. I bought a bootleg of it. Yeah. Somebody just made at one of those bootleg booths, which, how are those legal? I don't know. Probably not. That you find at like comic conventions.
Oh, they're not.
And
but again, a lot of it is stuff that there's like no one really caring about. Yeah, exactly. You know,
but when a legit edition of that cartoon show came out, I ended up buying that one just because I wanted to do my due diligence. Anyway, here's a letter from Alex.
Hi, Alex.
Dear William Bibbs Bibbiani and Whitney Ruckmeister McCool Seibold. Recently, a friend and I went to a mystery movie marathon at the Prince Charles Cinema here in London.
Oh, that sounds fun.
Ooh, that's the way they do it at the New Beverly. Like, when they do the all-night horror-thons, you don't know what the movies are going in.
Uh-huh.
It's like you get 4 to 6 movies.
Okay. Oh, it's just a whole bunch of mystery movies. It's a bunch of movies that are all a mystery to the audience.
Yeah, like they don't know.
I was thinking it was a bunch of Miss Marple flicks, but okay, well, that's fun, too.
Both
of those are fun ideas.
I remember there was an all-nighter we did at the New Beverly of Arnold Schwarzenegger movies.
And you don't know which ones you're going to show.
Yeah, you know there were Schwarzenegger movies. You've probably seen a lot of them. It's like, it could be the Terminator, could be Junior.
Yeah,
like you don't know what it's going to be.
Probably a little bit of both. Probably one cool thing and a bunch of crap, right?
It was stacked really well. New Beverly programmed it pretty well. But the one that sort of scared everybody out, it's like, this is the one that started around 2:30 a.m. Like, everybody's a little tired.
Yeah.
This has to be a good one to keep people in their
You're
states.
Debating whether or not you're going to go
like,
home.
Oh, no,
at
no,
that
okay,
point.
Do we really want to do what it one is. More? Let's see what it is. And the first line that appeared on the screen was, her name was Red Sonja. And everybody got up and left. Nobody wanted to stay for Red Sonja.
Red Sonja is not that. I mean, it's silly, it's a fun matinee movie.
It's fine, but if you're going to a Schwarzenegger all night, or you want Terminator 2 at that
point. How often do you get to see Red Sonja on the big screen? I'm totally staying for Red Sonja. I can see Terminator on the screen any goddamn time. Red Sonja on the big screen? Come
anyway, Alex says there were 5 movies, and I'd like to hear your take on them.
Okay.
The lineup of this mystery movie marathon.
Let's do it.
I'm going to list all 5 really quickly, okay?
Okay.
Okay, actually, let's go through a like timestamp.
Okay.
So let's say it starts at 7 p.m.
Okay.
This is in my mind, this is an all-nighter.
Yeah, and we're gonna be hazy on the time code. Yeah, okay.
So 7 p.m. Harvey, 1950.
Ooh, good pick.
Yeah.
Great
okay,
start.
Good.
Yeah.
Kind of
sweet,
sentimental
you know?
Kind of a picture.
Yeah. Light and fluffy. Yeah.
So that's at 7. At around 9:30 of What's Up, Doc, 1972.
Ooh.
Yeah, you're really alert at that point.
Also, we've got a vague rabbit theme. Because there aren't any rabbits in What's Up, Doc, but What's Up, Doc is something Bugs Bunny says.
There you go.
Okay, so we got a theme going.
So, okay, now we're at around 11 p.m., 11:30.
Uh-huh.
Rounding the midnight hour, we want something a little bit more intense. To Live and Die in L.A., 1985.
That is a shift.
It's a bit of a shift
in
tone.
That's a huge shift in tone.
If I were trying to keep somebody up, I'd choose something a little bit more energetic than To Live and Die in L.A. That's a little bit of a downbeat movie.
It's got an amazing car chase, but you got to wait a while to get to it.
And Willem Dafoe's really good in that.
Oh, yeah. I don't know if that's... I think I'd pick something a little bit more hyper.
Yeah, I think to
get people back up, but fair enough.
Okay, that starts at around midnight. So now you're at
great movie, by the way. If you've never seen it, see it.
So now it's about 2 a.m. You really want to perk people up? Miami Connection.
All right.
That'll keep people up.
Show people a midnight movie, a bunch of like fucking weirdness.
Uh-huh.
It's not my favorite midnight movie, but it's really, really fun. Yeah, sure. Makes sense.
And number 5, like the one to greet the sun, it starts at around 4 a.m., Mars Attacks.
Ooh, I like that.
That's
a good one.
Starts funny, gets intense, and gets like really weird at the end. I like that.
Interesting. I also like that it starts... kind of serious. You're starting with like a cinema classic, like Harvey, Oscar-winning, beloved film. Moving on to a celebrated film, but is also kind of wacky.
Yeah.
It's To Live and Die in L.A. that really sticks out in the middle there. I'm not sure where the transition occurs. Because we go from serious but kind of funny, you know, movie about things. Dude, What's Up, Doc? Is
straight up comedy. It's one of the funniest movies.
Screwball, aggressively trying not to be about anything.
Money laundering cop drama.
Severe money laundering cop drama. I don't know. I'm imagining maybe a cop drama with a little bit more oomph to it. Like, instead, like, one of the Bad Boys is or something like that.
Yeah,
maybe
you got
to really, like,
a lot of clunky and dumb action to keep you
up. Like that. Or a Lethal Weapon, something like that. But whatever. He went for the more severe thing. And then Miami Connection, just a sort of, like, just a hard about face from that. And then, Mars Attacks is a great closer.
Mars Attacks is a great closer.
Yeah, Mars Attacks is, it's fun, it's weird, you don't get to see it in the big screen very often. Yeah, I like that.
If you recall how the movie ends, they...
Yeah, it opens at the dawn.
Yeah, like the sun is coming up.
That's fine.
Tom Jones comes out of a cave and holds out his arm and a falcon lands on it and he starts singing That's Not Unusual. That's the ending of Mars Attacks.
You know what, that actually is perfect. You have a movie that ends at sunset or sunrise. Oh. That is perfect, actually.
Harvey ends at... Well, it's at sunrise in Harvey, right? Because they're walking off as the sun is...
Yeah, kind of.
But it's rising in the movie, isn't it?
They were out all night, though, remember?
Yeah,
they were,
so
like,
the sun is
at a bar,
rising.
So the sun would be rising, give or take.
So it's, they both end with a sunrise.
Interesting choice. Okay. Yeah. I'm trying to think if there's any meaningful
connection.
I guess
it begins with a sunset.
Does it?
Doesn't it? Actually, I'd have to go back and watch.
No, it begins with Harvey, like, going about his morning. And, like, his sister and his niece are, like, trying to get him out of the house so they could have, like, a suitor over. So it's a little different.
Never mind.
Okay.
I take back what I said.
Yeah. Well, that's a random collection of films. Sounds like a fun night. I like that almost all of those movies are movies you don't get to see in theaters very often.
Yeah.
Like, even To Live and Die LA, I'd be like, really?
Well,
I don't get to see it in theaters very often, so fuck it, let's do this.
Miami Connection was on, like, the really, really heavy in the midnight.
Yeah, that's the one
that
you get to see
a
lot, but yeah.
I feel like there's a certain kind of, like, cult underground movie that, you know, used to be a really rare find, but those kinds of movies are now so easily proliferated across the internet.
Yeah.
That something like Miami Connection no longer feels like an oddity. It feels almost like a gimme.
Yeah.
Even though it's an incredibly strange film.
Yeah. Well, some of them also get more hype. You know, if you had picked something like, what's that other one that was, like, from, like,
Samurai Cop?
No. The one that you were, like, one of the two people to see in theaters.
Oh, Dangerous Men.
Like, Dangerous Men doesn't have the clout. It just doesn't have,
Dangerous,
like, Dangerous
Men never really took off. Except here in LA, there was a little scene.
There's still a lot of people who could really be surprised by Dangerous Men. But I feel like if you have any interest in the cult movie scene, you've probably at least heard of Miami Connection.
Yeah.
So I think it just got so much buzz. I think it's a little less.
I think outfits like the Alamo Draft House, like, they'll actually sponsor and restore a lot of these movies.
Yeah,
that's
Vinegar
what happened
Syndrome
with,
did as well with New York Ninja.
But that's what happened with Samurai Cop, which was this very strange movie that was made over the course of many years. I think it was ultimately released in 1990. I don't recall the actual release date. It was made by an Iranian.
It was around there.
Amir Shervan. It starred Robert Zadar and a guy named Matt Hannon with who had a wig in some scenes just because they had to shoot it across a great time frame. It's a truly bizarre, cheap piece of work.
Very entertaining. Very entertaining.
Wonderful watch.
On its own merits. It's, you know, lo-fi, but they're trying to make a fun action movie, and it works.
Terrible dialogue, awful editing, even the color timing is off in a lot of scenes. And Matt Hannon, in the final fight scene, his wig, like, leaves his head. Like, you see a gap in between the wig and his head, and he pushes it back on. Luckily, it falls, like, right back on his head. So the scene isn't, but that's in the final cut of the movie.
Perfect. Keep it. That's a problem he'd have to face every day.
Samurai Cop has trouble with his wig every day. And if you're discovering that on your own, that's something you'd share with friends. That's this weird sort of rarefied thing. Mm-hmm. But thanks to Alamo Drafthouse, I feel like it's pretty commonly seen now.
But it deserves to be, though. I think it's fun, and I'm glad it found an audience. Mm. There's this weird thing where we almost resent cult movies if they become too popular.
Mm.
It's sort of like, it used to be.
It's no longer your thing anymore.
They used to. It's like, I found the Ark of the Covenant, and now everyone has one. Wait a minute. That's
Well, it's a little less special, isn't it?
Well, arguably, but in the case of art, I'm glad it proliferated.
If everybody's seen it, it's not a cult movie anymore, and you're like, that sort of cult appeal.
I don't know if that's necessarily true. Just because everyone's seen it doesn't mean everyone likes it.
I guess so.
You know? We should move on. But that's a fun night. I'm glad you got to have that night. I hope you stay for the whole thing.
Also, Hard Ticket to Hawaii is on Tubi right now.
There you go. Oh, classic. Genuine classic. Oh, I wonder if Blood Moon is anywhere. That's mine.
That's your Hard Ticket. Gary Daniels movie.
I keep trying to make Blood Moon a thing. There's a movie called Blood Moon, which is about like a werewolf, which is actually pretty good. But there's a movie called Blood Moon starring the great Gary Daniels.
He's Australian, New Zealand.
I think he's in New Zealand. Yeah. He was like a kickboxing champion.
Yeah.
And Blood Moon is not streaming anywhere at the moment.
That's too bad.
But it's about a serial killer who is killing all of the world's greatest martial artists using their own styles against them. Also, all those guys live in the same town, and the serial killer profiler, the Clarice Starling, if you will, is also one of the world's greatest martial artists, so he's also on the list, and he's paired up with a cop who does stage magic, and the commissioner is played by Frank Gorshin. Awesome!
The only thing it's missing is Cameron Mitchell.
I will say this. Other thing that's cool about it, the fight choreography, legitimately amazing.
Gary Daniels was a legit fighter, so he did all the choreography.
And indeed, a lot of people were cast specifically because they were good fighters, not because they were good actors. So the fight scenes are awesome. It's just the movie sucks. It's an amazing disconnect, and I hope you see it someday, because it's a treat. It's probably on YouTube.
It probably
is. That'd be a great place to find it. Look for Gary Daniels Blood Moon. I think it's two words, might be one.
That's early 90s.
Mid 90s. It looks like a movie from like 84. It was like shot in like 96.
Yeah,
it's like so weird.
Bizarre.
Yeah.
Here's our next letter.
Okay.
This comes from David. Hi, David. Hi, Whitney and Bibbs. So, after your recent explanation of what a horny movie is,
okay,
I was wondering what your recommendations would be for this genre genre of sorts. Adrian Lin was always a gap in my film-watching history, and prior to seeing Deep Water, I made it a point to watch his films and thoroughly enjoyed his approach. I've seen some main ones in the genre like Basic Instinct and Cruel Intentions, but was wondering if you had any other lesser-known recommendations. Love your work. Kind regards, David.
Okay. Well, again, and your mileage is going to vary on this. Not what works for everybody in terms of horny isn't going to work for everyone else. But just a caveat up front. You know,
I was lamenting that people were like assigning the word horny to the movie and not to themselves. Just like, I watched this movie
but you can get horny from watching like a commercial. It's not supposed to be if you just have a libido. That's
I suppose. But it feels like deflection to me. But yes, there. I feel like sex used to be a little bit more common in mainstream feature films.
Yeah, actual sexual content. Whether or not you saw it, it was part of the story.
Especially when I was young, there was this big wave of erotic thrillers. Basic Instinct was sort of like the crown jewel in that particular trend. Films like Indecent Proposal was in there. Jade was in there. Sliver was in there. Disclosure was one of those movies.
Yeah, there was this whole like Joe Esterhaas wave of erotic, mostly erotic thrillers. Sometimes just erotic. I'll give you my number one, absolutely yes, this movie. Because not only is it a horny movie about people who really want to have sex with each other, and do, but it's also a really, really great film, and that is the Wachowskis' first film, Bound.
Okay, yeah.
Bound is about an ex-con who is working as a fix-it person at an apartment complex, and one of the people who live in the apartment. That's Gina Gershon. It turns out one of the people who lives there is a gangster, played by Joe Pantoliano, and his trophy wife, played by Jennifer Tilly, who is very queer and seduces Gina Gershon, and together they decide to rip off the mob. Very sexy, but also impeccably crafted, really just ratcheted tension. It doesn't get much more taut than Bound. So Bound is definitely the first one that comes to mind.
I saw a film last year called The Voyeurs.
It has
an actress named Sydney Sweeney, who I didn't know this at the time, but she's in the TV show Euphoria, which I haven't seen. But that's about voyeurs. This young couple looks across the apartment in the high rise across the street from them, and they see this like sexy young photographer guy, and he's always like seducing models who are coming to his place for photo shoots. Unbeknownst to his girlfriend or wife, they don't know their actual relationship, and And of course, the Sydney Sweeney character becomes kind of obsessed with both of them and actually wants to be seduced by the photographer. And there's just a lot of nudity and sex in it. It's about being horny, and it ends in this very Tales from the Crypt way. It's really, really a pretty awesome movie. I'm trying to think of like other... erotic thrillers from like the golden era that people might not have heard of. You know what's a really good movie? Stripped to Kill.
Mm.
Have you seen Stripped to Kill?
I've heard of it. I don't think I've actually watched it.
Let me look up a little details on this. It was put out by Corman's company, actually. So, it made the rounds as a sleazy B movie, but it's actually a little bit more... a little bit more thoughtful than that, because it was directed by Kat Shea, and it's about a serial killer who's stalking strippers. Seems like, a good B-movie premise.
Oh, wait, is this the one with Mary Lou Henner?
No. It has Kay Lenz is in this one. Oh, okay. Norman Fell is in it. Greg Evigan is in it. About a cop who has to go undercover as a stripper.
Ah.
And a lot of the movie is devoted to just watching the strippers perform. But I think because it's directed by Kat Shea, it's directed by a woman, it's not like... specifically lascivious. It's actually really pro-stripper and sort of points out that this is really difficult work. This is a little bit more of a realistic view as to what it's like backstage. It's not just for titillation's sake. It doesn't play into a male fantasy.
Right.
But at the same time, there's a lot of nudity in it, and there's a lot of actual strip acts in it. But I think you're just as impressed with the strip acts as you are titillated by the naked bodies. I really like Stripped to Kill. I think you have to see it. The actual... denouement is pretty interesting. There's a trans character in the movie.
Okay.
And just sort of incidentally trans.
Okay.
I think that one's a pretty good movie.
I would say...
And it had a sequel called Stripped to Kill. Stripped to Kill 2, Live Girls.
Well, that tracks.
And I haven't seen Live Girls, but Kat Shea also did that one.
Brian De Palma has made his fair share of horny movies.
Oh, God. Yes, I have a good...
I would say particularly my personal favorite is a film called Body Double, which is a very strange film about a guy who takes on a house-sitting job, and there's someone who lives across the way, and he's got like a telescope, and he can see into her apartment, and he sees that every night she does a sexy dance and becomes obsessed with her. Mm. He falls in love with her, and he really wants to have sex with her. And then he sees her murdered. but then... he's watching porn one night. This is a real plot point. And he sees that a porn star played by Melanie Griffith is doing the exact same sexy dance. So his obsession transfers over to that. And he doesn't know what the connection is. Yeah. It's basically Rear Window beats Vertigo and a couple other things I don't want to ruin. It's all about a guy who's so horny, it gets him into a lot of trouble. There's some incredible filmmaking in it. There is maybe the least realistic portrayal of an adult movie film set I've ever seen. Like, this is like, how much money have you spent on this XXX movie in the mid-80s? There is no goddamn way they would spend this much money. But it is one hell of a sequence, and you absolutely have to see it to believe it. So Body Double comes to mind.
My Brian De Palma recommendation would be Femme Fatale.
You like this movie more than I do, but it is fun.
I think it's really underrated, but Rebecca Ramin plays a slinky, gentle lady thief who is robbing the Cannes Film Festival. Specifically, she is robbing the top off of a model, and she like lures the model into the bathroom and makes out with her while she's like slicing off her top because it's got diamonds on it. So she's like passing pieces of this top underneath the bathroom door while her compatriots are sort of taking it and putting them in bags. And this leads to this bizarre case of mistaken identity where she might have lost her memory, and Antonio Banderas is on her tail and is like photographing her and isn't sure if it's two women or what's going on.
It's legitimately a little hard to follow after a while, but it is nevertheless riveting.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. That's
and it's a hell of a movie. And it's Rebecca Ramin and Antonio Banderas, so there's already steam coming off of the
screen. Oh yeah, and this is at the height of both of their
this was 2005. Rawr-ness. That movie came out.
Yeah,
I really like Femme Fatale. I like that better than Body Double, quite frankly. But
I can see why.
I run hot and cold on De Palma. I think he makes a lot of horrible crap, but he's also made some legit classics.
I'm trying to think if there's anything else that's like. Because there was a bunch of crap, like Body of Evidence, where Madonna had sex with a guy to death, and Willem Dafoe was like the lawyer who has sex with her to see if it's real, and you're just sort of like, no to all of this.
And there are plenty of
hard pass.
I remember renting a movie once called Storm Swept. From, like, the ladies' horror movie.
No memory of this.
And the front had, you know, the usual kind of cliched image of, like, it's a woman sort of draped in a sheet. But yeah. Over her are these the giant kind of, like, scary owl eyes. It's like, oh, cool, I want a monster movie. I'm going to get this movie with this, like, owl monster where it's sort of sweeps in on a storm and takes people up. And,
right.
You know, maybe it's some cool shots of the monster. It turns out it was a haunted house picture.
Oh.
And people had gone there to film, like, the sexy bee movie. But, like, the demon in the basement was actually, like, a horniness demon. So they all got just, like, really horny, and they all start, like, sleeping around. It's clearly just this complete sexy schlock. And it's plenty sexy. It's really well photographed for a film of its type, because there's a lot of, like, long shadows and really interesting photography. But it clearly exists just for the sex scenes. It's softcore porn. And I can't really, in good conscience, recommend a film like Stormswept. Because it's not really that good a movie.
Well, you're telling people what they're in for. I'll tell you what, here is, this is maybe, if we're being honest, like the horniest movie of the turn of the century, at least this turn of the century. And that is John McNaughton's Wild Things. I don't know how it took us so long to get to Wild Things.
That is a sleazy ass movie.
That should have been the very first thing that came to our heads. That is Matt Dillon plays a I think he's a guidance counselor.
He's a guidance counselor who's having an affair with one of his students.
Yeah, he's a, and played by Denise
Richards.
Yeah, and then Nev Campbell reveals their illicit affair. Yeah,
she's like the bad girl in class, and then
just when you think you got your handle on what kind of movie this is, it gets hornier, and then it gets hornier than that, and then there are twists and turns and twists and turns. It's one of the twistiest turnies movies, but it does make sense. It's one of those things where it feels like it doesn't make sense, and you stay for the credits and they explain everything that seemed like a plot hole. they really did the work in Wild Things. It's a real film.
Kevin Bacon is in it. Bill Murray has a small part in
all of Kevin Bacon is in it, by the way.
Oh yeah, every last bit of it. I remember reading an interview with Kevin Bacon. He has a nude scene in the movie, and like he's stepping out of the shower. It's very super exploitative. Kevin Bacon's like all cut and looks really nice. And he was really shy. He didn't want to have a nude scene. Mm-hmm. And it's like, we want you to get out of the shower. The angles we have, like, we're trying different angles to see, like, what you're most comfortable with, Kevin Bacon, because we want to make you comfortable. Uh-huh. And, you know, every time we shoot it, you turn around and we see something. And they kind of flattered him. It's like, we see something. It's a lot to see, Kevin Bacon. God. And, you know, he's, like, a little bit flattered. And he says, well, okay, fine. I mean, how do I look? It's like, well, I mean, it looks great. It's like, fine, keep it in the movie.
Well, good for him.
he was a little bit shy, but when they said you look great, he was able to be at peace with it.
A movie I'm quite fond of came out at a very formative time for a lot of people in my generation was Fear, directed by James Foley and starring Mark Wahlberg and Reese Witherspoon.
God, it's a terrible movie.
It's a terrible movie, but it's a fun, trashy movie, I think. It's basically all about, hey, you know that like cute guy your daughter likes, but you know he's a bad influence? He's a horrifying killer monster. And it's all about how her unbelievable attraction to a very young Mark Wahlberg, and they film him like he's gorgeousness personified. Well, I mean, at the time, he was a model, you know. And
he had his own workout video and stuff. Yeah it was...
This movie ends, like, the climax of this movie is so, like, unbelievably over-the-top horrifying. Like, there's some real trigger-warning stuff, and, like, just in terms of, like, just, they lay siege to her parents' house. Like, it's just this incredibly horrible thing. So that's another one that comes to mind. But we should move on, but hopefully they give something to work with. There's plenty to choose from, and I'm sure there's plenty we missed.
Yeah.
Moving on.
Here's a letter from, you know what, there's no,
okay.
There's no name. If there's no name at the bottom, I'm not going to,
yeah.
Oh, although it starts with, from Joshy Poo.
Oh, well, there you go.
From Joshy Poo.
It's in there somewhere.
Hello, many O's, you sexy guys from the critically acclaimed.
Thank you.
I've been listening to you guys for years, but it wasn't until I saw Bibbs in an episode of What the Flick that I actually fell in love with his face, such beautiful eyes.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
I've always admired Whitney for very long, as he is an openly bisexual married man. I'm bisexual as well, so I've always looked up to Whitney for this, and also have a crush on him. Oh, my goodness, you're going to make me blush.
Yes.
Anyway, flattery aside. I wanted to ask you guys, what kind of TV do you watch nowadays? Quick answer, none.
I watch some.
You're always recommending great films, but any new TV shows could you guys recommend? I have three that I think you guys would like.
Okay.
One of them is the show Station 11. It's a pandemic show.
I've heard this is good, yeah.
From an Emily St. John book that predates COVID, and the pilot was shot before COVID as well, and this show breaks all the typical pandemic and end-of-the-world tropes. It's a show that made for theater kids, and has a great bottle episode with the main character being portrayed by Danielle Deadwyler, who gives an amazing performance.
Hmm.
Second is the show Southside. It's about a group of characters who are working in a Loan Depot store on the south side of Chicago, and all the hilarity that ensues. I thought about it when I was watching the show, because in one episode there's a dance competition, and one team is missing a dancer, and the coach wants to step in for her, but they have to get the judge's approval, and the coach cites the 1997 classic Air Bud, and its rule that nowhere does it say that dogs can't play basketball.
Nice.
Third is the show Yellow Jackets.
I've heard so many good things about Yellow Jackets. I really need to watch
this. About a team of high school girl soccer players from the 1990s that crash in the Canadian Rockies, and it shows how they try to survive while jumping to the future and showing some who survived. Two of the future women are played by Christina Ricci and Juliette Lewis, who are killing it. Yeah, I've heard a lot about Yellow Jackets. Just a quick question. Has William gotten around to watching Shang-Chi yet?
Yes.
All right. TV shows that I watch. Literally none.
Yeah.
I'm too busy watching movies. Actually, that's not entirely true. When new episodes come out for the animated series Big Mouth
on
Netflix.
Yeah.
I follow Big Mouth. I think that's a very, it's unbelievably crass and pointedly so. Like they're trying to be as pretty straightforward and you know, capture sexuality and all of its awkward grossness. But it's also incredibly responsible about its sexual attitudes, I think. It really is, addressing things in sort of a dirty, frank way, but in a very real, relatable way. Mm. And, you know, our relationship to our bodies can be a little bit gross at times, and puberty is a really difficult time. The premise of the show is it's about a bunch of 13-year-olds who are, like, kind of stuck in eternal puberty. And all of the horrible things that happen to you when you're going through puberty and all of the awkwardness therein. It's like the Wonder Years, but there's no wonder. And the gimmick of the show is each one of these kids has essentially like this imaginary deity that sort of stands over their shoulders that represents all of their hormonal thoughts. There's a horror monster and a hormone monster and a hormone monstrous. And they're played by Nick Kroll, the show's creator, and Maya Rudolph.
Ah.
And they only ever make, like, the most crass suggestions. Like, your hormones give you the worst advice. So the joke is, oh, I don't know. What am I going to do today? I don't know what I should do. You should masturbate, man. It's like, hey, what the fuck? I'm feeling kind of depressed. Why are you telling me this now, hormones?
That's funny. excuse me. I don't have as much time to watch TV as I would like either. Again, we do a lot of podcasts. We review movies for various other things. So, generally speaking, I don't tend to watch a lot of TV that requires a lot of emotional or intellectual investment. It tends to be stuff like, let's just watch something light while we eat lunch.
Yeah.
On that end, my partner Michelle and I, we have been catching up on a show we barely ever watched, but we're just sitting down and binging it now, Bob's Burgers. Everyone else knows and loves it and have forever. We saw a couple of episodes here and there, and then we just happened to start watching it all the way through, and we got to, like, 5 seasons in the last half year.
Okay.
So, like, that's something we're doing just for fun. For other stuff that we're watching that's a little bit more new, there's a great show on Netflix that got really overlooked, and it pisses me off because it's great, called Centaur World. It opens in this sort of really awesomely animated, post-apocalyptic wasteland where a bunch of heroes on their horses are fighting off wave after wave of minotaurs, which have conquered the land. And then a horse gets separated from its rider, falls into a portal, and ends up in a cutesy fantasy dimension where everything is a centaur and she's the only horse.
How bizarre. Okay.
And she ends up on a mission with a bunch of really bubbly, weird creatures who all have their own magical powers, but the only magical power they all have is they all have the power to shoot tiny versions of themselves from their hooves. Every episode is a musical.
Okay.
Every episode is a musical. And it's fucking great. And it actually does manage to really have real emotional heft to it. In a very unexpected way. I love it. I hope people see it. It's really, really good. I'm behind on this show. The show is on Disney. I've only seen about like the first part of season two, and it's on season two right now, called The Owl House.
You've told me about
The Owl House. Is a wonderful animated series about imaginative bisexual teen girl who is like sent to a boring summer camp to sort of like grind the rebelliousness out of her.
And it's not like teasy weezy kind of, you know, non-canonical dialogue. No. Like, she's explicitly bisexual.
Yeah, I mean, right? They don't talk about it all the time, but, you know, okay. The first person she has a crush on is a girl, and the next person she has a crush on is a guy. Perfect. So, boom. At least that's where it was going when I left the show, anyway. Yeah. I don't know how that storyline panned out yet. But, anyway, she falls into a portal and goes into this really weird, very fucked up magic dimension where she starts learning how to do magic. But it doesn't go in the way you'd think, and it's very, very cool. If you love Gravity Falls, you have to see The Owl House. It's not made by the same people, but it's got the same vibe. Mm-hmm. So that the pieces. I also like finding like really shitty trash shows.
I am following the new Star Trek shows.
Oh, there you go.
If you want shitty trash.
No. You don't understand. The show that I started getting into, and I because like the I think it was only one. I think it was like two seasons, but they're on Tubi. Is Sheena, starring Gina Lee Nolan from Baywatch, is a superhero series from the producers of Baywatch.
The older Sheena show.
From 2000.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I was wondering if there was like a new Sheena show. No. I remember the 2000 Sheena.
It's under those just like syndicated, low-budget action-adventure shows where Gina Lee Nolan plays a woman who was raised in Africa, she can turn into animals, and she fights drug runners and people looking for downed nuclear satellites, and it's all very stupid. Again, when I'm watching TV just for myself lately, I need something to help my brain shut down, not fire, not activate, and so I tend to gravitate towards that. I also hear there's new episodes of MST3K. I'm looking forward to checking those out at some point, but I haven't seen them yet.
They're on their own streaming service.
Yeah.
They launched their own streaming service called Gizmoplex specifically for these Good new for them. Episodes.
Good for them. I hope they're doing well. I'm a huge fan. I haven't had a chance to watch those new episodes yet because it takes a subscription and, life is hard. But I really want to check those out because I'm a Steve K fan, do or die. But anyway, that's what I'm watching right now.
Okay.
And cheesy cooking shows.
When it comes time to doze off, there's a couple of YouTube shows I kind of follow.
Yeah,
I'm not sure if these like really count. Like, there's a lot of film review shows. I'm very fond of the guys over at Red Letter Media. I love how much they just don't give a shit about just about anything. It's like, how come you're not doing a review of this? Because we don't give a shit.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Review Batman? No. Why not? We don't want to. And there's other like comedy criticism shows besides. I recently discovered, and this is something you kind of pointed me towards a couple times, and we talked about him, the Pitch Meeting comedian.
Oh yeah, that guy's fun. He basically reverse engineers a movie so that all of the bad decisions are explained as if they were pitched as good ideas and somehow they got warped
right.
the way to the screen, which is often how a lot of this shit happens. Everyone thinks they're making a good movie until they're not.
And he plays, the same comedian plays both the screenwriter and the executive. So he's having a conversation with himself. And they're both typically very enthusiastic about everything that's being pitched. Okay, I have this really awful idea. And whenever one of them points out some sort of like script problem, it's like, well, isn't this a problem? Because I noticed there's a plot hole just in this brief description. And the reaction is, well, here's the thing about that. I need you to get off my back about that. And the executive is like, oh, well, okay then.
One of my favorite awful cooking shows I ran into recently is a show on Netflix called Baking Impossible.
Uh-oh.
Have you seen Baking Impossible?
No.
They decide to... You work in a team. You get one person who does baking, and another person who's like a civil engineer, and you have to make baked goods that accomplish tasks. Like, we want you to build a load-bearing cake.
What?
We want you to build a golf course out of baked goods.
Like a workable,
like playable. A mini golf course. But yeah, a workable 3-hole mini golf course. But everything in it is edible except for the ball.
That sounds awful.
It's really stupid. Like, when would you need this? Ever. It doesn't make any sense in the world, but it's weirdly compelling because you're just, they're trying to make such a big deal out of it.
Hmm.
Like,
well, all of these shows are, like, cut and scored in, like, yeah, such a dramatic fashion.
Like, it's actually a big fucking deal. I love watching
the cooking game show Chopped. It's, you know,
yeah,
something that, chewing up for the eyes, I think everybody's seen Chopped at this, sure, point. But, at the end of a round, the chefs present the dishes they've made to the panel of judges, and they're giving, like, positive upbeat music while they're giving positive reviews. Oh, and I really liked what you did with the écru, and the tamarind paste was used very creatively. But your turkey was a little dry. And then there's this, like, dramatic sting, as
bom,
if...
Bom, bom, bom.
As if they heard, like, their home country was just bombed. It's like, oh, this awful music, it's like, dun, dun, dun.
So, this, like, could be the end.
This was a little salty. And all hope falls out of the bottom of the world.
I had to give up the Great British Baking Show because it was too intense. That's it's not a joke.
Show.
That's not a joke. They, every time something like, oh god, my creme fraiche fell off the top of my cupcake or whatever the fuck, it was played with such intensity and such tragedy that I was just like, I can't take this anymore. This is too harsh. There's a great comedian I love named James Acaster. Very, very funny guy. He did an episode of, like, Celebrity British Baking Challenge or British Bake Off, whatever it is.
Mm.
He has a bit in one of his stand-up shows where he talks about how he had, like, an emotional breakdown while filming the Great British Bake Off. Like, his girlfriend left him and, like, he fell off the wagon, but for, like, caffeine. Mm. And it completely changed it. Like, he totally... Like, he'd had, like, jet lag and hadn't slept in, like, 48 hours and, like, ended up just sort of... stirring the same bowl for like 2 hours and missing the whole fucking bowl. It's absolutely just an incredible story. But anyway, like I said, too intense for me. I gotta scale it back. Anyway, that is it for We've Got Mail. Thank you everybody for listening. Hope you enjoyed the episode. We sure did. If you want to write in, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Once again, that's letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Whitney, what is our P.O. box? If anyone wants to send us more stamps.
Yeah, wait, to go with
those are awesome
wonderful
stamps.
Irish stamps.
Never would have thought. What a treat.
Yeah, send it to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Yeah, those are already in a place of honor on my shelf. Thank you so much for that. Yeah, we're also on Twitter @CriticAcclaim. I'm @WilliamBibiani.
I'm @WhitneySeibel.
If you want more exclusive shows, you can head over to our Patreon, patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. We've got shows where we're reviewing every single film ever nominated for Best Picture. We've got our Oscars show. We're reviewing every single film ever nominated for Best Picture. We got an episode coming up real soon for that.
Yeah.
We have a show called Holy Batman. We've been reviewing every single episode of the 1960s Batman. That's on a very brief hiatus while we prep a spinoff show for Cancel Too Soon.
Yes.
Probably get to that hopefully next week. And plenty of other stuff besides. We do hangouts with our patrons, a bunch of other cool stuff. So thank you everybody for being a patron. If you are, you're supporting the show, you are keeping the show alive. And there's no other way it would be. So we're very grateful to you. And if you want to help out, we have a lot of exclusive shows for you. Anyway, I guess that's it, right?
That's it.
Don't forget Mother's Day is coming up. Head on over to Salt Cat Soap on Etsy. Salt Cat Soap is all one word. You can find us on social media @SaltCatSoap. That is the soap store that my partner, Michelle Lobbes, and I, we run.
Mm-hmm.
And we design soaps. We create soaps and make them into like fun shapes and sizes.
And smells as well.
Oh, that smells amazing in here. We've got a really, really nice one I'm very, very fond of right now called our Lawn Weekend Soap, which smells like fresh grass cuttings. It's so good. Anyway, perfect for spring. So anyway, Mother's Day's coming up. Maybe think about it. I don't know. Soft sell. Not going to push you. Anyway, thank you everybody for everything. And I guess that's all. Sincerely yours, Bibbs and Whitney.